Hello again, and welcome to another episode of our podcast, Everyone Has a Story. This is the podcast that goes hand in hand with our two quarterly lifestyle magazines, In Noosa Magazine and Hello Sunshine Magazine. The autumn issues are available now. And if you'd like your business or your brand to be part of our winter editions, reach out to our team. You'll find us on Facebook and on Instagram. Okay, on with today's special episode of our podcast. Today it features Hedley Thomas, multi-Walkley Award winner, investigative journalist and creator of the most listened to crime podcast in the world, The Teacher's Pet. This episode was recorded in front of a live audience at Park and Cove Restaurant at Pepper's Noosa Resort and Villas. And you may be surprised to hear in the episode that Hedley crafted and wrote some of the episodes while staying at Pepper's. Let's go behind the scenes of The Teacher's Pet podcast and discover extra details that were never in the original podcast, but now feature in Hedley's new book of the same name.
$60 million, when you talk about podcast figures and downloads and streaming, that's an amazing figure. On one hand, I want to say congratulations on the success of the podcast. On the other hand, we have to remember a woman lost her life, the impact that that cold case had over four decades for family and friends there on the northern beaches. So how do you reconcile that, first of all, when you stop and think, I've had this enormous success with this podcast and this story that I've been able to unearth, but yeah. there is the truth, you know, the true lives behind this podcast.
Yeah, thank you, everybody, for coming, and to Pepper's management and particularly Scott, the GM, for putting this on. Look, it's a great question you ask, because many people who became captivated by the storytelling and the podcast felt guilty at the same time because of the tragedy that lay behind the story. For me as the storyteller, I was not trying to achieve a podcast that would be downloaded tens of millions of times. I wanted to do a podcast that would make a difference. And there was no prosecution on foot when we started the investigation in late 2017. So the objective of the podcast was to try to develop enough public outrage and attention and uncover new material as the episodes unfolded, such that the authorities would realise they should have prosecuted this murderer decades earlier. So I think then it became a sort of a symbiotic relationship between our objective and the audience participation, and the fact that as the episodes did unfold, many new witnesses came forward. And one thing I haven't really talked about in the podcast before is the fact that I wrote and did a lot of the research for The Teacher's Pet right here in Noosa. We love Noosa. We had one of our first dates here 31 years ago, and so it's a very special place for me. And I remember back in late 2017 talking to other friends who come here regularly about this new idea I had for a podcast, the first one I'd ever contemplated. I wanted to call it The Teacher's Pet, and I showed them the draft video trailer in one of the villas here. They were like, oh my God, we don't know anything about this story. It looks incredible. And you look at where we've got to, you know, in the 6.5 years since, it's quite remarkable.
When you were working for The Australian, you're based in Brisbane. When you had that conversation with your editor and then the bigwigs in Sydney, was it always going to be a podcast?
Yes. I believed that the only way we could potentially get all of the detail understood was with a very deep diving podcast series that would go behind the scenes and talk to as many former witnesses and new witnesses as possible. But if you do that as a story, and at the time and still now I was working for The Australian, if I did that as a weekend feature article or magazine piece or a series of features, 2,500 words, one single episode of the podcast, if it's about an hour long, is 10,000 words plus. The Teacher's Pet became 16 episodes, and almost all of them were more than 10,000 words. You can see how much more detail you can go into. And it was the detail when people heard it, the overwhelming circumstantial evidence against a man who had gotten away with murder, who had been grooming schoolgirls while a school teacher on the northern beaches, and became, I think, a very powerful force in the community that led to petitions and all sorts of things to try to persuade the DPP to go forward. Wouldn't have been possible to develop that kind of public interest if it had been a series of stories.
So that was the plan all along, because I think you had written the first and published the first four episodes. And then as information started to come in and you were talking to and people were offering information, it developed as you went. How difficult was that? The information must be overwhelming. So was it like storyboarding? How did you go about crafting that into bite-sized chunks for an audience to digest?
Yeah, storyboarding sounds pretty sophisticated in terms of the method I had. Look, I had a framework that I roughly sketched out for the first handful of episodes. And in that framework, I wanted to begin the story where I believed Lynn had been murdered, which was in her house at Bayview on the Northern Beaches. And every time I visited that place, you know, I was struck by the sounds of the cicadas. The story in my mind, investigating it and interviewing, it had almost become too big in my own mind, and I was worried I couldn't do justice to it. So I was looking for a really interesting way into the beginning, into the first few paragraphs, and I did some research on the cicadas. And what is not very well known about the noise that these cicadas make, this deafening summer soundtrack of the Northern Beaches and many other parts of Australia, is that the noise is created through the mating process. And it just seemed like such an amazing analogy for what was going on with Lynn and Chris and the school student that he had been grooming and who he would later marry. Once I'd got that intro and got that down, I think I felt a lot more confident that I could go forward. But the reason we started the podcast series after only having written the first four episodes, it was because I just worried that I would be still at my desk writing for another couple of months and nothing was being produced. So I wanted to just start releasing them, and I thought that I could catch up and be writing episode five while people were listening to episode one, because they were weekly episodes. It was a crazy brave way to approach a podcast, particularly the first one that I'd done. Fortunately, I had a crazy brave editor-in-chief, Paul Whitaker, who's here today, and he backed the project and said, whatever you think it takes, we'll support. As the podcast series was still unfolding, it was like a live investigation. People who had listened to the first couple of episodes would contact me as I was writing episodes five and six, and they had new information. And that information then became part of early episodes. And some of the new information came from students of the high schools on the Northern Beaches, students of Cromer High School, where Chris taught, and students of Forest High School, where Paul, his twin brother, taught. At those schools, there was a terrible culture of grooming very young schoolgirls for sex. And it had become almost like a privilege of these schoolgirls in their minds. Some of them saw it as a special talent that they had to attract the attention of these school teachers. The other teachers turned a blind eye to it. And as people contacted me, many former students who were feeling quite guilty about what had happened, what they had seen and not raised, their voices were heard in the episodes. And then more people who were realising this podcast series was live, they came forward as well, and it just went on and on.
Let's go back. You and I are the same age. In 1982, we would have been 15 years of age when Lynette Sims was first reported missing. Do you remember the story from then?
In 1982, when Lynn disappeared, I was living at Main Beach on the Gold Coast with my mum and three sisters. The story of Lynn's disappearance was not even a story, even though Chris was a former first grade footballer. He was a celebrity model. He was very well known. The disappearance just didn't even rate a brief in the local Manly Daily or any of the newspapers. There was no attention paid to it at all. And then in 2001, the first inquest was held. By then, Lynn's replacement in the house, the former babysitter who became Chris's second wife, she had left him and moved back to the Northern Beaches and gone to the police, and she had described her suspicion that he murdered his first wife. So an inquest was held in Sydney in 2001, and I was in the Courier Mail's room in Brisbane at that time and looking at archived editions of the Sydney Daily Telegraph, and I saw a couple of very brief news reports about this inquest that had just unfolded. And it just was so intriguing that I wanted to know more about it, and I persuaded my editors to let me fly to Sydney, meet the police who had investigated the case for the coroner. The copper that I met at a Northern Beaches police station was Damien Loon, trying to persuade a coroner to make a finding that Lynn had been killed unlawfully. And he let me look at all of the police files that were tendered as part of the brief of evidence for the coroner in 2001. And that was an amazing thing for him to do. I'd never been given that kind of access by a police officer before in my career, and I haven't since. In some ways, the karma bus just caught up to Chris Dawson and ran over him. And I was a little bit obsessed at that time with the case, and I wanted to write a book. And then I wanted, many years later, when podcasting came along, to develop the story for a podcast.
It didn't come up in the podcast itself, but you mentioned it in the book, Hedley. Your grandmother, your father's mother, mysteriously disappeared in the same region where Lynn was reported missing back in 82. Did that have anything to do with your interest?
Yeah, that's right. And I think it had a profound impact on my determination to follow this case. After my father died in early 2017, you know, I was a bit lost. You know, he had been a great supporter and mentor and a wonderful dad. I knew that he had grown up wondering what had happened to his mother, Gladys. It was very painful for him. She had some, probably what would now be regarded as depression, but then just wasn't really talked about in the mid-50s, and wandered away from their home on the Northern Beaches where my dad lived with his sister and his mum and dad. Some clothes were found on DY Beach, footsteps into the sand, and nothing, no other trace was ever recovered. When you grow up hearing about this, and then as an adult, one, what happened to my grandmother, and then the case like Lynn's disappearance comes along, there's a very strong impact on your interest. And often as journalists, when we're most effective, are propelled by something personal, something in the background that is pushing you to go harder and try to exhaust every possibility. And I felt that when I started investigating Lynn's disappearance and travelling around the Northern Beaches, all these places where my dad had grown up and where he went to school, and I felt like in some ways in the months after his passing, I was a little bit closer to him, even though I wasn't trying to investigate any part of my grandmother's disappearance. I think she just swam out and kept swimming, either deliberately or through misadventure. But it was the catalyst for me to really commit to this case in a very significant way.
And I think this comes up in your book as well, Hedley. Your grandmother disappeared in that same area, not suspicious circumstances. But Chris Dawson and his brother then taught at a Gold Coast school that you had attended, but you had left.
That's right. I went to school in Southport, a school called Keebra Park State High. Keebra Park was a really strong school for rugby league. I think it still is one of the strongest schools for rugby league. In the 1980s, it was a great school, and I left there at the end of 1984 to start a cadetship at the Gold Coast Bulletin. Well, actually, I was a copy boy first, and then I started a cadetship. Within about 6 weeks or 7 weeks of me walking out of Keebra Park State High for the last time as a student, Chris Dawson was walking in to start as a school teacher for the 1985 school year. He had killed his wife, taken all of the assets that she owned, and remarried the former babysitter. And they had moved to the Gold Coast and were building a house at Coomber. He was probably considered a great catch as a teacher. And some of my friends from school who were a little bit below me and some who repeated got to know him. I suspect that I would have met him over the next year or two because I was covering schoolboy rugby league as a reporter for the Gold Coast Bulletin early in my career. But it was just another one of those extraordinary coincidences that probably also contributed to my interest in this case.
Were you concerned that if and when you made progress with the case, and that if Chris Dawson was then arrested and charged, that a court would find it difficult conducting a fair trial for Chris? How did you manage that?
Yeah, and that's a really good question. That's always been the elephant in the room with this case, because when I started the podcast, Chris Dawson's crime was 36 years old. And what that then triggered was a period 3 years long of very sustained and committed defence by Chris Dawson's team, where they argued that although he had been charged with murder and with carnal knowledge, he should never have to face a trial. All of the proceedings should be dropped and cancelled, because the podcast, The Teacher's Pet, had been so widely heard, and that everybody who had heard it believed that he was guilty, so he couldn't get a fair trial in front of a jury of his peers. We got through that probably by the skin of our teeth. That really attempted to put the podcast that I had done and my own actions as a journalist on trial. They said that I had, in interviewing the witnesses, contaminated their memories and so on, even though the authorities had failed Lynn for 3.5 decades.
After those first 4 episodes, talk about your work plan in terms of you would write, then we talk about getting things legal. That must have been a really tight turnaround. How did it work? How did you do that?
It was incredibly grueling. It was exhausting. It got in some ways a bit comical. If it happened today, people just would not believe that it could have been such a sort of a high wire act. I was also organising voice actors, because we had police statements that I needed to reproduce in audio.
You did that all by yourself in terms of auditioning who would voice this and who would voice that?
Yeah, that's right. And wow. I'd be calling on friends and family, and I'd be driving around to their houses and then sitting in the car with them and recording them as they read a statement. And often when I'd grab my wife to stand in the wardrobe, the walk-in wardrobe, to record the lines for the former babysitter's mother, who had died, but she had a police statement that I needed to reproduce. This floorboard would creak, and you can still hear the squeak in the actual episodes as she's doing those lines. But I think people appreciated that this was an unusual podcast in that it was dynamic, on the run. It wasn't the very polished kind of podcast that people produce today, where it's all in the studio and the audio is just pristine. My audio is pretty ropey in parts. I didn't understand noise levels. I'd enlisted my then 19-year-old son's childhood friend, who wanted to be an audio engineer. I'd enlisted him to help cut up some of the audio to take the pressure off our main audio producer, Slade Gibson. And I'd go over to his house. He was in a university share house with a thumb drive of audio files, and I'd leave them in this running shoe on his deck in Brisbane the night before. And then he'd take the thumb drive and cut up the audio and send it back. Oh, you know, we do it differently now.
Yeah. And nothing more agonising waiting on some content that you've sent to be legaled and then waiting for that to come back, and then having to, if necessary, to rewrite something. Yeah. Did that happen often?
Yeah, the lawyering was intense because every sentence, every paragraph, and we're talking about 10,000 word plus episodes, had to be very carefully legaled. We took enormous risks with this podcast. Our lawyers told us at the outset, when they were first reviewing the proposal before anything had been broadcast, they said, look, make no mistake, this podcast, your investigation, is going to accuse a man of murder, and we're going to give you legal advice on how to minimise the risks. But if he sues for defamation, and if there's no police charging, we're going to have to prove in a court of law that he killed. We would have to demonstrate to try to vindicate our journalism that this man, never been charged with anything, murdered a woman whose remains have not been found since she disappeared January 1982. Again, enormous challenges and risks, but it's been worthwhile.
If you could have your time again in terms of preparing this investigation, preparing the podcast, you talked about the amateurish way in terms of some of the audio was recorded. Mm. Would there be anything that you would do differently, Hedley?
I put a lot of strain on my family relationships, definitely on, on loved ones. So I think I would have asked for more help early on. I was already being given a lot of time from my normal day job, writing for the newspaper and digital site, to do this, you know, months of time off to do it. I didn't feel like I wanted to keep asking for more help. Perhaps the podcast worked because I worked with my audio producer harder than I'd ever worked in my life. We didn't have the staff and we just had to make it work. It was too grueling. We did finish with the 16th episode, not knowing that Dawson was about to be arrested. Slade, who did all of the audio production, he composed all the music, you know, beautiful guy who lives in Brisbane, former guitarist for the band Savage Garden. He was just utterly shattered, and we only half joke about how when he would hear my noisy car coming down his long driveway in Brisbane, he'd just go and hide under the bed towards the end because he had to cut up every piece of audio. I would write the script with the time codes and he then had to place everything and then redo it and edit out all the glitches and write the music.
I can't even imagine how time-consuming...
Dozens of tracks.
How time-consuming that would be. Editing your own stuff sometimes is a lot of work, editing someone, especially with the volume of material that you had, Hedley. A mutual colleague on our table mentioned before, someone that knows you longer than I've known you, said this would probably something that you never imagined when you started out as a copy boy at the Gold Coast Bulletin, that you'd be talking about this podcast that is topped the charts all over the world, that you have a book signing, that you're signing book, that you've written a book. When you think back to when you started, was this ever even a seed that you thought, this is what I'm going, I could end up here?
No, I never would have believed it possible. And I think that it's the special effect that audio has on all of us that has made such a big difference with this case in particular and many other cases that is reinventing investigative journalism. I wanted to be an investigative journalist when I was very young. And I think that when I started working on The Teacher's Pet, I'm 56 now, so we're going back to when I was 50. I was ready because I had a lot of experience by then as a journalist. I had good contacts. I had the knowledge to back myself and withstand pressure from police, from lawyers, all sorts of people. And I don't think anyone without a lot of experience could have done the story in their 20s or 30s. So it was the culmination of more than three decades of reporting. And, you know, this is one of the things I really worry about as media outlets try to cut costs. You lose so much in experience when you get rid of that tall timber, and we've got to be very careful, particularly when there's never been more demand for podcasting and very detailed, deep diving stories, that the older hands who know how to do it best are kept on and continue to do their best.
Ladies and gentlemen, Hedley Thomas, give him a round of applause.
Thank you.
Multi-Walkley Award winner, investigative journalist and creator of the podcast The Teacher's Pet, Hedley Thomas, in conversations there. I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you did, then go and check out Hedley's original The Teacher's Pet podcast, available on all platforms where good podcasts are found. And if you enjoyed this episode, In Conversation with Hedley, then please feel free to share the episode about on your social media platforms. Until next time, take care.